This is 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station, Community Amplified.
The number one misinformation about elections right now is the safety and security of these things.
Investigating primary election rumors. What are your worries? I'm News Director Matt Bush, and this is WYPR's News Roundup. Prepping for the primaries, plus we hear from the next CEO of Baltimore City Schools.
What it means for me right now is I'm pumped up and excited. What I'm hearing is the common message. People really want to have strong schools for their children.
And ahead of the weekend, we bite into the value of every hot dog at Camden Yards.
And we have some absolute monstrosities of hot dogs coming, Crab Mac Dog and others.
That's all next, but first, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Libby Casey. The White House says Special Envoy Steve Witkoff and President Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner are planning to travel to Pakistan Saturday for a new round of direct talks with Iran. Vice President Vance had been the lead U.S. negotiator but is not planning to travel this weekend. Iran's top diplomat says he is also heading there. Meanwhile, Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth is urging European countries to join the U.S. effort to open the Strait of Hormuz. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports it could take 6 months to clear the key waterway.
At a news conference, Hegseth repeated President Trump's threat to destroy any Iranian small boats laying mines in the narrow strait, through which about 20% of the world's oil passes.
We would welcome a serious European effort to do something about this strait and this passage, considering it's their energy capabilities that are most at stake.
But since oil is globally traded, the blockade is driving up prices worldwide. On Thursday, Trump said the U.S. is using minesweepers in the region, but there are no known U.S. minesweepers there. Hegseth dodged a question about Pentagon estimates that it could take 6 months to clear the strait. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
The Food and Drug Administration is speeding up its review of psychedelics for treating mental health. Today, the agency said it is giving priority status to several psychedelic drugs, which companies have been studying for depression and PTSD. NPR's Will Stone has more.
Three companies are submitting drug applications to the FDA. Two are for psilocybin, the active ingredient in magic mushrooms for treating depression. The third is for a drug that's similar to MDMA, which has shown promise for PTSD. FDA is giving out special vouchers that are intended to expedite the agency's review of the drugs. It does not mean the drugs are FDA approved yet. This comes on the heels of an executive order from President Trump that directs federal health agencies to prioritize research on psychedelics. Scientific interest in these drugs for treating mental health has grown substantially in the last few years, though an effort to get MDMA approved for treating PTSD fell short in 2024. Will Stone, NPR News.
An American soldier involved in the military operation to capture Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro was in court today. Federal officials say Gannon Ken Van Dyke used his insider information to win more than $400,000 on the online prediction site Polymarket. The case is drawing attention to Polymarket, the use of which is actually banned in the United States. But Polymarket is accessible with a virtual private network, or VPN, which disguises where someone is based. NPR's Bobby Allen has more.
The Trump administration has dropped investigations into Polymarket that were started under President Biden. And, you know, while Polymarket's main competitor, Kalshi, is subject to more rules by being regulated by the federal government, Trump officials don't seem too bothered by Polymarket operating overseas. In fact, Donald Trump Jr., the president's son, is an advisor and investor in Polymarket.
A study published this week found youth suicides declined since the launch of the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline in 2022. NPR's Ritu Chatterjee reports.
Among 15 to 34-year-olds fell by 11% between July 2022, when 988 launched, and December 2024. That translated to more than 4,300 fewer suicide deaths during this time period compared to what scientists would have expected based on trends in prior years. Hannah Wislowski is chief advocacy officer at the National Alliance on Mental Illness.
This is the first time we've had validation that 988 is truly having an impact, and all of the work and an investment around building out 988 may be turning the tide on a suicide crisis in our country.
States like Virginia and Rhode Island with the highest uptick in calls to 988 saw a larger decline in youth suicides, 18% compared to 11% decrease in states like Alabama and Texas, which had the lowest uptick in calls. The findings are published in JAMA. Ritu Chatterjee, NPR News.
Canada is seeing a surge in applications for citizenship from Americans after Canadian law changed in December, loosening the requirements. It opens citizenship to anyone who can prove they have a Canadian ancestor, not just a parent. Under the new law, descendants of Canadians are now considered citizens, but they must provide proof to obtain a certificate of citizenship. Immigration lawyers in the U.S. and Canada say they've been overwhelmed by clients seeking help submitting proof. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org.
And good afternoon. You're listening to the WYPR News Roundup. I'm News Director Matt Bush of the award-winning WYPR Newsroom. It's that time each week that we take an in-depth look at some of the news around the Baltimore region. And this week we are looking at the primary election. It is now under 2 months away here in Maryland, June 23rd. Are you excited, apprehensive, confused, ambivalent? Well, we've got you covered no matter what you're feeling. All week we've been collecting your thoughts and posts about the upcoming primaries. Again, it's on June 23rd, but early voting starts on June 11th. If you want to vote by mail, that deadline to request ballot is on June 2nd. And if you've already requested a mail-in ballot, those are going to start going out in just a couple of weeks. To answer all of your questions and maybe calm your nerves, we brought in an expert, Jared Damaris, the state administrator at the Maryland State Board of Elections. He's been fielding a downpour of questions while also squashing every election rumor, at least trying to. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
So probably the biggest question anyone's going to have right now, not just about the elections in Maryland, but anywhere in the United States, but we'll say this for Maryland, which is now in less than 2 months, is safety and security. So is the election going to be safe and secure in June?
Of course, yes. I mean, that's probably the number one misinformation about elections right now is the safety and security of these things, especially mail-in voting. And with a June primary, we expect a large number of voters to avail themselves of mail-in voting because of summer vacations. Everyone wants to go, and this is the perfect opportunity to use a safe and convenient method of voting here. The voting equipment that we use has been EAC certified, it's been tested, and the mail-in process is safe and secure with lots of checks along the way there to keeping the voters informed where their ballot is, when it's going to be received, and basically when it gets counted as well.
Now, if you go to the State Board of Elections website, you have a rumor control, rumor mill page. Tell us about what that is and how people can read it and maybe submit their own questions and concerns onto it.
So, yes. So one of the bigger things here now is to battle this misinformation is to have other people report back to us what they're seeing. I mean, these algorithms right now on social media is so specific that what you see and what I see are two different things. And so, you know, we want to make sure that a voter has the ability to report and ask questions to the trusted source. And we're trying to even make it easier. So you don't even have to go to our website anymore. We now have an app called Go Vote Maryland. So download it. And right then and there, there's good information right at your fingertips. And you can report any sort of social media questions that you've come up with right then and there as well. And we're expecting more on those platforms now.
Yes. So we have some of the lists of all the rumors that have been kind of circulating this year. We're going to tick through them one by one. We're going to start with polling places. People impersonating voters to steal votes. That's one. There are questions about the legitimacy of ballot drop-off boxes. That's going to be a really big one for all those people who are voting by mail. So what are the claims? What's the reality?
So When you get a mail-in ballot, we send you a notice right now saying, hey, expect a mail ballot coming to your mailbox. So the voter now knows, basically, because we're going to start mailing them out May 11th to everyone. If they never signed up for a mail-in ballot, well, then notify us, and we would make sure that we can figure out why and how that occurred and investigate that. Once the mail ballot goes to that individual voter, they can vote it, and then we can either track it if they put it back into the postal system when it gets to the local boards, or they can go right to one of our over nearly 300 drop boxes located throughout the state and drop it right in there, and an election official or staff member will go and collect it on a daily basis and process it. Once we get it, the local or state board, the notification goes to the voter saying it has been received. So now the voter can feel confident in the fact that it's been received, coupled with another notice once it's been counted. So they're well aware of the process. So if a person tries to steal your ballot or go to the polls at that point, they're saying who you are. These things will all be flagged, and then we will investigate and work with the state prosecutor's office to see if there's any sort of double voting or fraud.
Okay, so now about marking your ballot, the ballot marking device. Yes. People who have not voted before, what is that marking device, and what are people worried about, and what shouldn't they be worried about?
So there are two ways to mark your ballot in Maryland here. One, it's the paper, and then you fill in the little ovals, and you put it through the scanner. The ballot marking device is just a big pencil, in a sense. Basically, it helps disabled voters and anybody who wants to avail themselves of this equipment. It is, a touch screen. You go through it and you select all your candidates. It prints out the ballot. You get to review it again, and then you put it in the scanner. The thing is, when you touch the screens there, you just want to make sure you hit the candidate you select. This ballot will never switch candidates. There's multiple times for you to be able to review the ballot before it actually goes through the scanner. The only time your ballot counts is when you take your ballot and put it through the scanning machine.
Okay, so for people who are voting by mail, mm-hmm. how do they mark their ballots to make sure nothing goes wrong?
So they receive it, they fill in all the little ovals, and then they put it right back into the envelopes and then put it in either the postal service or through our drop boxes.
Number two pencil, or can they use a pen?
They can use a pen. They can use a pen and everything else. Just make sure you fill in the ovals correctly.
All right, terrific. So that's also for voting by mail. One other thing to talk about is people mailing their ballots back in. Maybe they're not comfortable doing that. Maybe they have whatever feeling about the Postal Service. We'll start with that. The Postal Service is going to be fine for this election. Is that right or wrong?
So one of the things is that right now the Postal Service has changed their postmark rule, and this has been causing some apprehension among people that want to vote by mail. Maryland is a postmark state, meaning that it has to be postmarked on or before election day or primary day in order for your ballot to count. So if you're going to vote by mail, because the process has now been delayed a little bit, it's not the same day that you're going to mm-hmm. drop it into a mailbox that it's going to get postmarked that day. It could be 1 or 2 days later mm-hmm. that, as you get closer to that June 23rd primary date, we highly recommend the use of a Dropbox. And, that information, where they're located, is on our website, or just download that app and, they can pull up the address right there and there and have it, right onto their phone and direct them right to the nearest location.
And again, the deadline to request a ballot is June 2nd.
Yes, exactly.
To register to vote?
So register to vote is actually June 2nd as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important because if you're an unaffiliated voter and you wish to switch your party, because Maryland is a closed primary state, that is the deadline to switch your party. If you're not a registered voter at all, Maryland still has the ability to do same-day voter registration during the early voting period as well as on election day. But if you're an unaffiliated voter, you can't go and do same-day voter registration mm-hmm. to switch your party. So that's the earlier of the deadlines.
And just to say that again, Maryland is a closed primary state. You have to be a member of either the Democratic or Republican Party to vote in that respective party's primary. You can't be an unaffiliated voter showing up hoping to vote in the primary of your choice. Early voting's next after we've talked about mail-in voting. Early voting begins on June 11th.
So early voting's in person. The locations, there are over 100 locations throughout the state of Maryland. You know, each county and location has their own. Again, all that information is on our website or in the app. It runs from June 11th through June 18th from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. It's just like everything else. It's just in-person voting, but it's just more conveniently located facilities that anybody in that county or in Baltimore City, you can go to any one of those locations to vote. So you're not on primary day. You have to go to your polling place. Here, it's any one of those facilities.
And they'll be able to tell which district in particular, maybe let's look at legislative districts in for the General Assembly seats. They'll be able to know I may live in the 46th district in the city of Baltimore, but I might be going to a polling place early voting that's not in the 46th.
That is correct, right? They have all the ballot styles for any voter in their county or in Baltimore City.
And same-day registration can happen during early voting, right?
Yes, exactly.
And that's for, again, people who are who have not registered at all.
No. Right, exactly. That's why it's a little bit of a nuance for the primary election.
And then there's voting the day of June 23rd. Tell us about that.
Yes. So, you know, basically, if you're going to vote on June 23rd, primary day, it's the last day to make sure your voice is heard. You have to vote in person at your polling place. Come out and vote.
Then the count begins at 8 o'clock on the night of the 23rd. Tell us how that's going to go. Is there anything new this year? And if people are concerned about the ballot count, what do you want to share with them to reassure them?
So, one, we're going to canvass a little bit earlier than just on Election Day, by the way. So all the ballots that we're starting our canvass 8 days before the start of early voting for all the mail-in ballots. So we're getting, as that goes on.
Does that mean, for us news folks, we'd like to know, does that mean the first drop of ballots will come at 8:01 so we get the results of early voting?
You'll get a lot more results. Yeah. So not only, you know, we'll make sure that, you know, all the mail-in ballot votes that were counted prior to Election Day will be released. Early votes will be released as well as Election Day results. We still have a bunch of ballots that still have to be counted because at one point there's a lot more mail-in ballots that would be received, and that canvass starts 2 days later. And we then, if there's any individuals that had issues voting on Election Day or in person and they had to vote provisionally, we count those afterwards. But basically, at the end of this, we want to make sure that all our ballots are counted 10 days after Election Day. And the local boards will start certifying elections at that point there, and then the state will certify the election. And we do audit as well. Mm-hmm. I was just going to – before that. Yeah. So before the state certification, we're going to do a risk-limiting audit of all the election results, and that's the first time that we're doing it this for this election and moving forward with it.
But again, going back to the question of all – safe and secure.
Yes.
Ballot safety, ballot security, and will every vote be counted?
Yes. And also making sure that the ballots themselves, there's a chain of custody in which we can follow at all times.
Well, in the news this week, not just the voting results in Virginia, but also a nominee to the Federal Reserve stumbled when he asked who won the 2020 election. And according to President Trump's most recent executive order, protecting the right to vote may be under threat. Is that what you understand? What's involved the state right now and how to make sure that there is no federal interference, not just in the June primary, but maybe even more so looking to the November election?
We've been addressing the recent executive orders as well as some of these comments that have come out of the administration. I've made statements. They're on my website there. One of the big things is that the executive office does not have the authority to nationalize elections. These are state-run elections. We're going to run Maryland's elections according to Maryland's laws so that everyone can feel safe and secure that we are following everything according to the laws and regulations of this state, as well as all the federal laws that have been passed. There's been issues about voter registration lists and giving those informations over to the federal government as well. We are currently in litigation over that. Mm-hmm. We are making sure that Marylanders' voters are protected and their privacy is protected.
Jared Demarinis is the elections administrator for the Maryland Board of Elections. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
One place people are going to be taking their time voting this year, maybe, is in Baltimore County, where so many things are on the ballot. Coming up after this short break, our reporter John Lee is going to give us a breakdown of the county executive race in Baltimore County. You're listening to the WIPR News Roundup. Stay with us.
Support for WIPR comes from the B&O Railroad Museum, presenting Family Fun Day, Day Out with Thomas, April 25th and 26th, and May 2nd and 3rd, featuring train rides, live entertainment, games, and more. Information at borail.org.
And welcome back to the WIPR News Roundup. I'm News Director Matt Bush. Joining us in studio right now is one of our many award-winning reporters, John Lee, covers Baltimore County for us, and he has had a busy month, and he's going to be in for another busy couple of months because voters in Baltimore County have a lot to decide in the June primary. We're going to focus today on the top spot, the race for county executive. John, thanks for coming in.
Always good to be here, Matt.
Baltimore County, which is home to around 850,000 residents, that makes it the third largest county in Maryland. That's also a population that's larger than four U.S. states. Well, voters there are going to elect a new county executive this year. Kathy Klausmeier was appointed to fill out the term of Johnny Olszewski after he was elected to Congress in 2024. She was appointed on the condition she would not run for the office this year. Three of the people who approved her selection are running to replace her, plus a few others. We're going to look at the Democratic primary, John. So tell us who's running there. Just give us a brief rundown of each candidate.
Sure. Well, let's start with the council members. There are three of them. Julian Jones, he's been on the council since 2014, Izzy Patoka, and Pat Young. And so you have those three. And then the, I guess you would call perhaps the outsider candidates, Nick Stewart and then Mansoor Shams. Councilman Jones, who I said has been there on the council the longest, he's a retired firefighter from Anne Arundel County. So he really talks about his campaign as being, as he's someone who's dedicated to service. If you look at Izzy Patoka, he will talk about his experience as a planner for decades in the city and the county and the state as well, and tries to talk about it, how it can help communities. Pat Young, first-term council member, he also had a couple of terms in the House of Delegates. He's all about accountability. When he arrived on the county council, he kind of looked around and said, no, you guys are sort of winging it. We need to, like, come up with some rules and regulations as far as public hearings and amendments being made public and that sort of thing. Nick Stewart, something of an outsider candidate, talks a lot about making Baltimore County more affordable, more modern, can't keep doing the same sort of thing. He helped to co-found the We the People Baltimore County, which is a kind of a smart government group. And then the last person to enter the race pretty close to the deadline is Mansoor Shams. He also is talking about affordability. He is a Marine veteran, so he talks about that experience as well. He's really about trying to make things more affordable for people. And an example he gives is kind of an interesting idea of having mini marts all around the county on county property that would provide like low-cost items for people. So that's your field. There's five of them, and I talked to a political science professor, Roger Hartley, recently about him, University of Baltimore, and he said, and I think it's true, one of the most interesting and important races in Maryland this year.
So two of these candidates have distinct fundraising advantages. Mm-hmm. All can be competitive, but two have distinct fundraising advantages. Who are they? Which ones, and what does that buy them?
Well, Julian Jones and Izzy Patoka have been running for county executive really for years. So they're sort of waiting for their opportunity, and this is their opportunity. And you mentioned the fact that Kathy Klausmeier, she had to make a deal with the council that she would not run this year for her own term. This is why, because they didn't want to be running against a sitting county executive. So Jones and Patoka, each the last campaign finance reports, had well over $1 million to spend. None of the other candidates were anywhere close. And so just kind of driving around Baltimore County these days, anybody who does that, like I do, you're seeing the signs. You're seeing the Julian Jones signs. You're seeing the Izzy Patoka signs. Not so much the other guys yet. Granted, I haven't been everywhere in Baltimore County. I'm not saying there aren't Pat Young signs up there, but I'm just seeing a lot from Jones and Patoka. So they have a lot of money. They're both, I'm sure, if you are a registered Democrat in Baltimore County, your mailbox will not be safe soon. You're going to start getting a lot of flyers from these guys, particularly Jones and Patoka. And both of them also plan to go on TV probably sometime in May. Now, that doesn't mean the other ones aren't aren't viable and aren't interesting. Nick Stewart, for somebody who's never run for office before, you know, I think on his last campaign finance report, I think he had like $400,000. That's nothing to sneeze at. And Pat Young is doing something kind of interesting. You know, he is running as the first publicly funded county executive candidate. It's the first time it's been offered in this year in 2026. And his message is that, no, I'm the guy who's not going out there asking for big donations. I'm in this strictly for the residents of Baltimore County.
There's no runoff in a primary election in Maryland. So you have five candidates, some very, very well funded. The winner could win this thing at 25% of the vote, if not even a little lower than that. So very thin margins. And Baltimore County obviously has a history of very thin margins this particular primary election 8 years ago, in fact. So what are some issues that might sway just enough people that maybe aren't top of mind for folks on an election that has such slim margins?
You know, I think it would it's an interesting question. To be honest, probably a difficult question to answer. I think if you're Nick Stewart, you're hoping that people may be disgusted with the current county government. He has certainly taken out a club and gone after the three council members over the issue that they kind of set up this deal where they were going to be able to increase their pensions based on the salaries of future county councils. Stewart did a lot to blow the whistle on that after that was made public. And so I'm certainly he is hoping that that will resonate. I think for Julian Jones, what he is hoping that a big issue will be the economy, jobs, creating jobs. He is seen as someone who is, you know, open to development and that sort of thing. And so, but he says that drives the economic engine of Baltimore County. Izzy Patoka, one of the things he has often talked about is like the environment, and it kind of goes back to his idea of making communities more livable. And then you have Pat Young, who, again, going back to the accountability of government, he's really trying to make that the issue. You know, there are other things floating around in the county. We had a big dust-up involving the inspector general in Baltimore County last year. Will that resonate a year later? I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, what have voters been saying to you? What have you heard at these forums? You've attended some of these forums. What are people saying?
Yeah, well, a lot of people are asking about things like about affordability, that sort of thing, and certainly about good government. But sometimes you get the feeling that, and I want to go back to 2018 because you referenced it. Johnny Olszewski won the primary by 17 votes, which was just unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And in that one, what I think people think settled that and won it for him was the campaign itself. We had two candidates who really went after each other and really bludgeoned each other. Mm-hmm. Olszewski didn't do that. Now, he had money, so he was able to do his own campaign. So you kind of look to the campaign and what kind of campaigns these guys are going to run, who's going to be the most effective, who's going to get their message out the most effectively. I think, you know, particularly when the margins can be so thin, I think that's going to – I think who runs the best campaign has probably got a pretty good shot of winning this thing.
And lastly, there are two Republicans running for their party's nomination. John did a story on them. Head to our website to read more about them. Republicans haven't held this office since 1990, though, so in many ways the Democratic primary does serve as the de facto general election primary. But there are Republicans running. Check out John's story about that. But what makes this significance is, again, the power the county executive has in Baltimore County. And, again, this is a county that has a higher population than four U.S. states. So why is it so significant who wins this?
County executive holds virtually all the cards. Apologies to the county council. Not that they don't have things they can do, but when the county executive presents their budget, and it's a $5 billion budget, so it's a big budget, all the county council can do is cut it, which they usually don't do much of that, or they cannot increase it. They can't even move money around. Got to follow the money. That's where the priorities are. You know, everything from money for education to money for sidewalks and potholes, and county executives usually sprinkle them that kind of stuff around the county. So it really, we're going through this right now. Kathy Klausmeier presented her budget a week or two back, and the county council will review it, but they're not going to really have a whole lot probably to do as far as tinkering with it. And in the end, that will basically be what's the spending plan for the next year. So an immense amount of power for a county, in the county executive. And as you see with Johnny Olszewski, who now is in Congress, often a stepping stone to another political job.
John Lee is award-winning reporter for us here at WIPR. He covers Baltimore County. He's going to have a busy couple of months, but he's going to be back on the show to talk about some of those other races that aren't county executive that voters will be deciding there. Again, June 2nd is the deadline to request a mail-in ballot if you have not done that already, if that's how you would like to vote. Those ballots actually start going out on May 11th. Early voting for the primary is June 11th through the 18th, and the primary day itself is June 23rd. And remember, Maryland, closed primary state, you must be registered as a Democrat or Republican if you want to vote in that respective party's primary election. John, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we hear from the next CEO of Baltimore City Schools as he prepares to start the job on July 1st. Then we pass the mic to someone who's been behind the mic before, Brett Hollander, broadcaster for the Baltimore Orioles. And for those of you heading out to Camden Yards this weekend to see the Orioles, we've got some news you can use. The cost and content of each Camden Yards hot dog. You won't want to miss that. This is the WIPR News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush.
Practical Parenting, the new podcast from GBMC, helps empower parents in the trenches to find joy in the process and thrive through it all. The goal? To ensure parents have the resources, support, and confidence they need. Practical Parenting from GBMC, available on WYPR.org, the mobile app, and wherever you get your podcasts.
And welcome back to the WIPR News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush, the news director here at WIPR. This week, we have a guest who is new to Baltimore, so new he hasn't moved here yet, but he has taken the time right now to come to our studios here on North Charles Street and talk to us about his new job before he heads back to Philadelphia to collect his things. It's the new CEO of the Baltimore City Schools, Dr. Jermaine Dawson. Dr. Dawson, thank you so much for coming to the show and welcome to the city.
Thank you so much for having me here, and I'm so excited to learn everything I can about Baltimore. I live not too far away up in Delaware, and I'm so excited to come. I've met so many wonderful people here, so much great food and so much culture here, and I can't wait for my family and I to move down and become a part of Baltimore.
The first day of school for next year obviously doesn't come until the end of the summer, but your first day in office is going to be on July 1st. How are you feeling about things right now? Obviously, a job change comes at you fast, so how are you feeling about it right now?
I'm feeling great, and I do believe, and I live by the philosophy, and you're right, I start July 1st officially. And my philosophy is there's only one CEO at a time. Dr. Santelices is the CEO. And during this transitional period, I am looking forward to learning from her and listening to the team. What it means for me right now is I'm pumped up and excited. I've been in schools. I've been in communities. I've talked to many different people. And what I'm hearing is the common message is that people really want to have strong schools for their children. And that's what we're going to continue to lift up and make sure that we do.
So looking at your resume, your LinkedIn, you've worked in a lot of school systems before you come to Baltimore. Atlanta, Houston, Birmingham, Jacksonville, Orlando. You were back in Atlanta and Birmingham then, too, before heading to Philadelphia. A lot of big city schools, so you're pretty well-versed, I would say, in city public school needs and issues and concerns. What are you going to take from all those other cities and bring to Baltimore?
Well, let me tell you, someone would look at that and say, well, you've been a lot of places. That's a negative. Actually, I see it as a positive. And I did it intentionally because I knew one day I wanted to be a superintendent, and I never wanted to be a superintendent or CEO that only had one track experience, one perspective. But I also recognize that bringing those experiences are great, but I'm in Baltimore. And what I'm assuring our larger listening community is that I'm promising not to just bring those things and make Baltimore Philly or make Baltimore Houston or make Baltimore Atlanta or Jacksonville. I want to build upon from learning from our Baltimore families what they need. And then I will pull from my tool chest of experiences to be able to make sure that we can apply that with our team here at City Schools to ensure that we maximize on our Board of School Commissioners' vision. That's my superpower.
So as you inherit this district as CEO, some things, maybe three big things facing it right now, test scores. They are rising, but they're still lagging behind the rest of the state. I plan to improve that, but also, absenteeism and also transportation. Our friends of the Baltimore Banner did a big write-up about how a lot of students are coming to school late every day just because of a lack of transportation options or reliable ones. So you have those kind of three big things. As you look at it going into office, how are you going to address those?
So all three of those, and I want to say high level that I am already working with the team to listen and learn about some of those problems. I don't want to be a top-down leader. Mm-hmm. I want to be more of a synergistic leader that's listening to the larger community to solve those problems. But I've already kind of gotten versed a little bit around some of our transportation needs. And what I will say to you is that's one of the things that I plan on tackling and working with the larger community, our team, our city, our state government to really go after that can impede our students' ability to learn and then for the ability for them to demonstrate mastery on state assessments. So I want to tackle that, and I want to do it in a very cohesive manner, bringing all of our key leaders around the table to solve that problem. Another big one for me, I think, is attendance. Students cannot learn if they're not in school. And what I've learned is that the safest place many times for our young people during the school hours is at the school. Mm-hmm. And so it is not just the responsibility for me of our teachers and our administrators and school staff. The attendance is not a school issue alone. It's a city and it's a community issue. And so I'm willing to work to bring everybody around the table so that we can tackle that problem. And then, of course, the academic piece is really supporting and undergirding our teachers. My philosophy mm-hmm. is high quality instruction in every school, in every classroom, for every student, every day. And then the other population that I'm really going to be focusing in on intently is our special education population and our African-American and Latino boys. And what is happening when I look at the data that's happening with these two particular groups and our multilinguals, the third arm mm-hmm. of that, is how do we dig into that data?
What's the data show you? What's the thing that needs to be addressed?
Yes, the data is showing as we continue to make significant progress, we still recognize that there are some areas that we own. Mm-hmm. This is a systemic issue across our nation, especially in our urban school populations. And so we really want to tackle that head on, provide supports that will continue to engage our young men to get them fired up and excited about school. Not saying that they're not,
right.
but there are pockets of kids that may not be, and how can we re-engage them.
Many articles written about you this week throughout the Baltimore media, and they all touched on your childhood, and in particular that you lived through periods of being unhoused. According to the State Department of Education, about 6,000 city school students were unhoused during the 24 school year. 28% of Baltimore's school-age kids lived in poverty. That's according to the NEE Casey Foundation. As your role as CEO of schools, what do you want to bring to the table to address this particular issue in the city?
Yes, so I want to work with our community agencies and really support how they are working with families. I want to be able to, how can we engage and support that work similar to what I've done in some of my previous district to make sure that we have the tools, the resources for students who may be living without a home, living mm-hmm. in cars or on porches similar to what I had to, that there are resources in schools to support those students. We provide opportunities for them to feel a place, a sense of belonging, and that we not only do it in support of the child while they're mm-hmm. in school, but how can we wrap our arms as a larger community around the family to support them, because we know that some of that could be impeding that child's ability to come to school and learn.
And just
day.
To say this to our listeners, what do you say to our listeners? 6,000 is a staggering number of people to be on as kids to be unhoused in a city.
Yes, so I would just say to our larger community that we will be dedicated in supporting those students to make sure that they are getting the same high quality education every day. We know that we're on the education side of this and not on the, you know, the mm-hmm. all the other components that come along with that. But I think if we can partner with those entities together, that we can provide that wraparound insulated support for the whole family. And I'm willing to roll up my sleeves and do that, because that is very, very area that is very, very important to me, because I know what that feels like, sound like for our young people.
And lastly, what drew you to Baltimore? And you have kids too. How will they feel about the city school system? So you have a personal stake in this too, right?
Yeah, so my little one is so excited when I finally got a chance to tell her that we were coming to Baltimore. She just jumped and screamed on the bed, and she knows her mother and I don't like her jumping on the bed. She just jumped up screaming. We come to Baltimore a lot. Long before I even knew that I was even applying for this role, Baltimore has been one of those cities that I've always loved. I love seafood, so the crab cakes is something. I just hope I don't gain any extra weight from eating all of those crab cakes. But I'm just very excited to be here. It's a beautiful city. The family and I are ready to really immerse ourselves into becoming true, what y'all call it, Baltimore.
Baltimoreans, yes.
Baltimoreans. I want to make sure I say that. So we're ready to do that.
Fantastic. Dr. Jermaine Dawson, he will be the CEO of Baltimore City Schools come July 1st. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having us. It's been a pleasure.
Stay with us. You're listening to the WYPR News Roundup. We'll be back after this short break.
I'll never forget the day I read a book.
I'm Tom Hall. On the next What Are You Reading? My guest is the conductor and singer Heidi Ackerman, the founder and artistic director of Charm City Sings and the music director of the Frederick Chorale. Heidi's reading a classic by the feminist Roxane Gay and a book of poems by David Larvey. Join us for What Are You Reading? Friday during All Things Considered, brought to you by Eye Candy Optician. I'm going to do it again.
As spring returns to the land of pleasant living, our thoughts leap to summer evenings and Maryland's largest free outdoor concert series, WTMD's First Thursdays. From June through September, we bring the best local and national acts to Baltimore's Canton Waterfront Park, mixed with local artists and vendors, a wide array of tasty food, and a bunch of friends you just haven't met yet. WTMD's First Thursday concert series kicks off June 4th. Admission is free. More details at WTMD.org.
People who listen to NPR News face the facts with familiar voices. We are all figuring out the world together.
You just pointed out this is a complicated subject. We could spend the hour just talking about this. But what do you think needs to happen?
And though the news can be hard, we let ourselves laugh.
Do I have a short voice?
Huh. If someone said annoying voice, maybe I'd be like that.
Morning Edition from NPR News is here for you and with you. Listen every weekday.
Monday through Friday, beginning at 6 a.m. on WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back to the WIPR News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush. And now it's time to pass the mic to a voice you're very familiar with if you've ever tuned in to an Orioles baseball game.
Pass the Mic is made possible by a grant from the T. Rowe Price Foundation, recognizing 45 years of advancing thriving communities and building financial well-being. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the participants and do not reflect the views of the T. Rowe Price Foundation, T. Rowe Price, or any of their subsidiaries or affiliates.
Pass the mic.
Hand that to me.
Pass it over here.
Pass the mic.
Pass the Mic gives you the space to share your stories, issues, and concerns your way. Today we pass the mic to Brett Hollander, broadcaster for the Baltimore Orioles. He overcame a childhood struggle with dyslexia to chase his dream.
Pass the mic.
You get point, a 2-0 lead going into the late innings. And I'll tell you, you are in serious difficulty.
I grew up obsessing over Orioles baseball, particularly on the radio. And I remember going to games, 7, 8, 9 years old, and looking up at the broadcast booth, and I would see John Miller or Chuck Thompson or Fred Manfred.
And we'll bring up Al Bumbry, who was grounded to second.
And I would just watch them call the games. And I'm lucky that my parents told me I likely would not be the future everyday second baseman of the Baltimore Orioles. And I thought this was the next best thing. And I said to myself at a very young age, I would be a broadcaster for the Orioles. My name is Brett Hollander. I'm in my 7th season calling Orioles baseball, and I'm born and raised in Baltimore. At 8 years old, I would take a dictaphone my mom had from work, and I would go and turn down the TV sound in their bedroom, and I would call games.
Good spot for Al Bumbry right here.
And listen back and analyze it and try and do better the next time. When I was 15, I got to intern at WBAL for the old Sportsline show that I would host years later. And I came in as hungry as could be. I'd come in on like a Friday night just for fun, just to be around a radio station, talking shop, meeting interesting people. I could not get enough. This thing in my brain told me this is what I'm supposed to do. And the biggest thing was I got to go to a high school that had a little rinky-dink radio station. And I said, how cool would it be to put some sports games on the radio? No one had ever done that before. And it was a success. Then the next step was, and again, early 2000s, let's put the games on the internet. And I was lucky enough to have a classmate who was the technical genius behind all of it. And we were able to get permission, raise money for equipment, and put a broadcast on. We were doing lacrosse, football, and basketball. And we were broadcasting games at Hopkins. It kind of took off. I brought in other classmates. Everyone had a job. One person may have been the analyst for a game. One person was the spotter, the person who's showing me who has the ball. And then another person would do stats. I've been very lucky. I've been around great people, and a couple years ago, I had a big decision to make, and I was very happy. I had afternoon drive on the radio, and the Orioles called, and I'd kind of moved on from this original dream, and I called my brother, and I said, what should I do? And he said, what would the 8-year-old version of yourself do? That was that. I hope this is the last job I ever have. It does not interest me to do any other form of broadcasting in another market. It just doesn't. I grew up listening to John Miller and Joe Angel. You almost rooted for a rain delay. Those guys were so funny. I try and bring that, even when the team is having a bad year. This is supposed to be fun. I mean, this is baseball. This is an escape from every part of your life that is tedious and hard and complex, and we all deal with these things in a strange world. And this has got to be that thing that people rely on. I really want our broadcast to be entertaining above all.
Basayo, line drive, base hit, left center field.
Play-by-play on the radio, it's not an exact science. It's more art.
The Orioles collect their second hit down to their last strike, and we're starting over.
There are things you say inside a clubhouse in baseball or around a batting cage that maybe you wouldn't say on the radio. I kind of want to bring some of that to the broadcast. And there's definitely a newness to some of those words that we use in baseball. When a starting pitcher does well, they now say, he really shoved. Or when a ball is hit really well, when I grew up listening to it, we never said this, he got it on the barrel. You know, a lot of people like to say, he's on the bump today, instead of saying he's on the mound. That's just inside baseball language. It's not going to be everyone's cup of tea. But again, you can't play for one person. You have to play for another baseball term, the big part of the ballpark, where that's where most of the hits are, between left center and right center.
The ball dug out in the left field corner.
You need to have thick skin at times in this business. I'm sure there's some people who don't like my style. I'm more about the feel, the vibe, the ballpark, the energy, the history, the nostalgia. What I go on is my passion, my authenticity, Orioles baseball, and Baltimore. It's my DNA. It's what I do. So I'm dyslexic, diagnosed as a kid. School was really challenging for me. And what I always heard my whole life was, this is not about intelligence. I think my parents were always confused because I could always communicate well. But reading was very, very hard, and really still is. My parents worked so hard to keep me on grade level. I feel very proud that I persevered. I think it's made me the person I am today in a lot of ways. But I started a charity at the Odyssey School in Baltimore County. It's a fundraiser. I just know that if you are in a system where, one, you cannot afford any extra support and you are dyslexic and you're falling behind, you are in big trouble. I developed a relationship with the head of the school, and I said, whenever I can pull this off, I want to do this. It's a labor of love, but we've raised hundreds of thousands of dollars now for this. And so the goal is to make that life easier and get these kids up to grade level and beyond. I always say this as a joke, but I mean it. Put on my tomb, broadcaster, Baltimorean, and go O's. In the end, I'm pretty simple. I love to have a good time. I love being with my family. I love this town, and I never want to leave.
Pass the Mic is produced by Elizabeth Nonemaker, senior producer Mallory Pinkard-Pierre, and executive producer Amy Walters. Sportscast audio courtesy of WMAR and WBAL. Pass the Mic is a presentation of Baltimore Public Media.
To learn more about Pass the Mic, visit our website, WIPR.org. For those of you headed to Camden Yards this weekend and curious about which hot dog to bite into while you're there, we got you. That's next after this break. You're listening to the WIPR News Roundup.
Check out the latest episode of Your Child's Brain, a podcast series produced by Kennedy Krieger Institute with assistance from WIPR. I'm Dr. Brad Schlager, president and CEO of Kennedy Krieger Institute. Join me and my guests, Dr. Michelle Melacosta and Eleftheria Chorzakaki, Leo's mom, as we discuss caring for children with complex medical conditions. Your Child's Brain is available on the first Thursday of every month at WIPR.org, KennedyKrieger.org/YCB, or wherever you stream your podcasts.
Max Roach was an iconic drummer and civil rights activist whose innovative career opened in the bebop era and extended to the end of the 20th century. I'm David Bren Johnson, inviting you to join me for a centennial tribute to Roach with It's Time, the Max Roach Story, this week on Nightlights.
Celebrate Jazz Appreciation Month, made possible by Keystone Corner. Sunday evening at 6 on WYPR.
When most people think of Dubai, they envision wealth. But with the war with Iran spilling across borders, the country's tourism has slowed. Migrant workers feel the difference.
Are you getting the same salary now as you did like 2 months ago?
No, we have different.
Because of this issue for missiles.
I'm Scott Detrow. The ripple effects of a regional war on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered this afternoon at 4. On WIPR, where support comes from Keystone Corner, Baltimore, in Harbor East, welcoming Ms. Lisa Fisher and Grand Baton on Friday and Saturday, May 1st and 2nd. Ticket information at KeystoneCornerBaltimore.com.
Welcome back to the WIPR News Roundup. And hot dog, we've almost made it to the end of the show, but not quite. We have a taste treat for all of you today, especially for those of you headed to the ballpark this weekend, where the Orioles have a three-game series against the Boston Red Sox. You never know how long the game is going to last, because baseball is the only sport that doesn't have a clock, and that's what makes it so great. Is it a one hot dog game, maybe two hot dogs, maybe more? Well, according to two intrepid reporters at our news partners, the Baltimore Banner, it depends on which hot dog. Not all glizzies are created equal, it seems. Who knew we'd ever say that sentence? We invited Banner reporter Alan James Vestal here to the studio to explain his voracious reporting on how to get the most bang for your buck when it comes to hot dogs at Camden Yards. Alan, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And first off, I think for all of us, thank you for doing such intrepid reporting on the really, really important stories that face all of us in the Baltimore region.
Indeed.
So your goal was to find out which hot dog delivered the most meat, fixings, bun, all of it, for the price, and you really had your eye on the value dog. So tell us how you came up with this whole idea.
Sure. So this actually all started when my reporting partner, Sapna Bansal, and I were at a game with other Banner reporters last year. The value dog had just been introduced, and we started looking at just the size and the kind of proportion of the value dog versus the standard jumbo Camden Frank. We kind of turned to each other and said, you know, I don't think there's any way that the value dog actually, you know, provides kind of an equivalent amount of value for money. And then we said, you know what, wait, we can report on this.
Yeah, we're going to be looking at these hot dogs across a number of different metrics. We're going to be weighing them with and without the bun. We're going to be seeing what bang for your buck you get. And then we're going to be, of course, taste testing them because we can't help ourselves.
We went to different stands. We got multiple of the same kind so that our measurements wouldn't be skewed by any one outlier. But we also were able to try all of the various kind of specialty dogs with different toppings and just, you know, assess the weight and the taste of those as well.
Now, one of these guys involves a potato bun, Salvadoran coleslaw, chorizo, all sorts of things. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, so that's actually an offering from a shop that's based in Landover and has a concession stand in the park right behind home plate. They had a chorizo dog that was just so interesting because it was so unlike any of the other ones, you know, just very very light and very kind of zesty with peppers and with a kind of spicy slaw on it. And so that was definitely one of our top marks.
So you are a trained data journalist, so I don't know if we can call this a scientific study exactly, but for this purposes, I think we can. But you were doing measurements. It wasn't just taste. It wasn't just money. There was all sorts of other things, actual measurements, too, that you were doing, correct?
Oh, yeah. We had a whole setup there in the kind of outfield along the scoreboard at mm-hmm. Camden Yards. Brought a kitchen scale, brought some twine so we could measure how wide around the hot dogs were, brought a ruler that we unfortunately did have to pitch at the end of the game because it was just a little bit too, sausage logged, right? We really set out to do this as kind of a nominally unserious story, but that we really took seriously trying to kind of find the best value for readers and for ballpark goers.
Yeah, I'm excited to see just how much bigger the jumbo dogs that they sell alongside the value dogs at the same stand, just how much bigger they actually are. Really looking forward to busting out the kitchen scale and getting to the bottom of it.
And what we found was that the jumbo dog costs $8.25, actually provided slightly more value for your money when you talked about the overall weight, right? This is all without condiments, despite the fact that my right. reporting partner and I were, you know, very much wanting to add the condiments right afterward. The jumbo dog, $8.25, gives you a little bit more value for your money than the $4.49 value dog when you talk about the total weight. But a lot of the value dog's weight is bun. And so when you actually just look at the meat in question, it's, many, you know, tens of, I think about 50 cents difference in terms of what you get. The behemoth at the park is the warehouse dog, which is, it's got pit beef, it's got queso, it's got pickled onions. It sells for $23. And when you actually look at the value for weight, right, it actually winds up being the cheapest option or the most bang for your buck, I should say. We really enjoyed the taste as well. You also can't beat the crab mac and cheese dog.
There's Club Oval, which you have to have certain tickets to get into the Club Oval. A lot of the ones you're talking about are ones that people can get anywhere in the ballpark, right?
Yeah, actually, the only hot dog that's exclusive to the club level is a Baltimore dog, which is new this year. It's got the fried bologna and the sauerkraut and onions on it. And we liked it okay. I think we were maybe not the target demographic because yes. Neither Sapna nor I grew up in Baltimore City. But you know, definitely that's the only one that's exclusive. Otherwise, they're all, hot dogs for the people.
Well, affordability is the big deal in this year's election. It is also heading to the ballpark. And maybe that's what the overall arching theme of today's show is here on the News Roundup. Alan James Vestal co-wrote Grading the Glizzies, How Each Hot Dog at Camden Yards Measures Up for our news partners at the Baltimore Banner, where he's also a data reporter. We have a link to that story on our website. Alan, thank you so much for coming in. And again, thank you for doing the important work for all of us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for this week's WIPR News Roundup. Next week, we'll have your suggestions on what's good in the Baltimore region and beyond. Give us a call at 410-735-1616. That's 410-735-1616. Leave a voice memo with your name and where you're calling from, and we may hear your recommendations on the air. I'm Matt Bush, the news director at WIPR. Elizabeth Nonnemaker, Sheila Cast, and Rob Tim helped us with production today. Shania Mapson and Sean Murphy are our studio engineers, and Amy Walters is WIPR's executive producer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.
Support for WIPR comes from the Washington National Opera, presenting a fully staged production of West Side Story, May 8th through the 10th at the Lyric Baltimore. Ticket information at washnatopera.org/tickets.
I'll never forget the day I read a book.
I'm Tom Hall. On the next What Are You Reading? My guest is the conductor and singer Heidi Ackerman, the founder and artistic director of Charm City Sings and the music director of the Frederick Chorale. Heidi's reading a classic by the feminist Roxane Gay and a book of poems by David Larvey. Join us for What Are You Reading? Friday during All Things Considered, brought to you by Eye Candy Optician.
I'm going to do it again.
Driving on October 9, an accident, and a moment changes everything, both for the innocent victim and for the woman, midwife, and mother, who will now spend years caged in one of the largest prisons on Earth, hoping to regain her foothold on humanity. From the next step, judgment, fire escape. Do not miss it.
Snap Judgment airs every Saturday at noon on WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station. Also a proud partner with the nonprofit news site, the Baltimore Banner. Together, WIPR and the Banner are bringing local news you can trust to Maryland.